not a major part of this presentation. The presentation is more about why there's poverty in Africa, what we can do about it, as it says. And he'll go into more about the development of Africa, maybe some history and economics. Not even too sure, but we're in for a treat no matter what. He's supposed to be an excellent speaker. you're at the highest standards of speaker caliber. Anyway, so how many people know about Heifer International? Oh, wow, pretty much everyone. So can anyone tell me what the main goal of Heifer International is?
What I've seen, I'd say probably trying to help small older farmers become self-sufficient through livestock.
Yeah, so that's basically the main idea. Another component of Heifer International is passing on the gift. So when one of their animals that was donated gives birth, they're kind of obligated through the Heifer International program as a recipient to also give a gift of an animal to another family in need. So in that way, it's kind of passing on the gift. It's supposed to be like a domino effect of one family helping another, and so that's kind of their aim to end world hunger in a way, is sort of this chain effect. Heifer International has been a pretty small club on campus. We started about 5 years ago. We're looking for new members, so please sign up on our list and we'll barrage you with emails. And come to our really cool events. We do a lot of fundraising and hunger awareness events, and we really like having speakers come to educate us as club members as well, get the word out about world issues and what solutions we can propose to these issues that are obviously very complicated. They don't involve just animals, they involve economics and social development, social justice, which a lot of Heifer International also tries to take into account. So yeah, without further ado, I think we're going to have Professor Barrett take over. And we're going to have a short Q&A for any questions at the end. And please take refreshments if you would like as well.
Thank you. Well, thank you all for coming here. So I especially want to thank Megan for inviting me. It's always sort of a treat, and my colleagues who are clearly older than the undergrads. So, you know, we all frankly get sort of excited when there are undergrads who are interested in not just taking a class and learning something, but actually taking it to the next step and trying to do something. So it's really nice to have the opportunity to talk to a student group that is aiming to do something about poverty in Africa, not just hear about poverty in Africa. So let me take two slides to try to answer probably the most common question get, which is, why do you work in rural Africa? So the first slide is meant to make two points to you. Unfortunately, my clicker pointer died about an hour ago, so I'm going to have to use my hands, old-fashioned technique. So the horizontal axis here is time. So the data start around 1980 and 2010 are the most recent data points. The vertical axis tells you the percentage of the population, or a headcount share, as people refer to it. And the size of these bubbles represent the total number of people, so the total population. In this case, living on $2.50 a day or less, in inflation-adjusted terms. So this is considered the international poverty line. This is double the so-called dollar-a-day extreme poverty line. And there are two core stories to take out of this graphic. The first is that we can do a huge amount about poverty. Just look at the East Asian experience. East Asia is the yellow dot here in the yellow ball. And look that in 1980, so just a generation ago, how many of you had parents living in East Asia in 1980 or earlier? Okay, I was guessing a few of you. So at that time, 95% of the population of East Asia lived on what is today $2.50 a day or less. So 95% of the population of East Asia was poor. Today, less than 40% is. That's an astonishing rate of progress. If you think about, in the course of just one generation,
we've gone from almost everybody was poor to less than half of the people are poor and falling fast. So a truly remarkable transformation took over in East Asia over this period. And that's the hopeful story that we must not lose sight of. It is possible. It is also a big task, the global scale. You know, although the population has more than doubled in that generation, the number of people below the poverty line really hasn't changed. Very small increase in absolute numbers relative to a population that's now 7.2 billion, more than double what it was in 1981. So as a share of population, we've seen a steady decline, clearly driven by what's happening in East Asia. So one story is that there are a lot of people who are poor, but you can make rapid progress, even in places where poverty is almost universal and very, you know, a large number of people. But the second story is that poverty today is primarily South Asian. So there's a dot for Africa that works just behind the green one here, because the poverty rate in sub-Saharan Africa is almost identical to that in South Asia. There are so many more people in South Asia. So in South Asia, although the rate has been declining slowly, we've gone from less than a billion to more than 1.25 billion people living below this poverty line. So poverty is primarily a South Asian story today, which would seem to confuse you when I said people ask me, why do I work in Africa? So the poor mainly in South Asia, but there's at least some progress. In sub-Saharan Africa, if you can see the red dots behind, there's really not appreciable progress in the headcount poverty rate, the share of the population that's poor. It's staying at pretty much the same level, and the size of this ball has more than doubled. The population under the poverty line in Africa has more than doubled. But that still is really only part of the answer. The real answer to the question of why do I primarily work in Africa is this graph. This takes that same poverty line, this is the same graphic, but now the poverty line is what some of us refer to as the ultra poverty line. 1/4 of the global poverty line. 62 cents a day per person. Less than a pack of gum. People really survive on this. It's not pretty, but they do it. And back in 1981, this was still an East Asian phenomenon. We had almost 500 million people living at that truly desperate standard of living in 1981. Today, that number has vanished. There are hardly any people in East Asia living below the ultra-poverty line today. If you want to see a really remarkable story, think about that. We've almost extinguished ultra-poverty in East Asia in a generation, from 500 million people to 11 million. Remarkable. That has brought the world rates down. Even South Asia. South Asia, the ultra-poverty rate is only about 2% today. It's very low. The reason I work in Africa is we've not seen that progress in Africa. So in Africa, the ultra-poverty rate has oscillated 20 to 25% of the population consistently over the last generation. And the number who are living at this extremely low level standard of living or lower has more than doubled. And where the global, represented in blue, the global population of the ultra poor back in 1981, about 1 out of 8 lived in Africa. Today, more than 3 out of 4 live in Africa. So the experience of truly grinding ultra poverty is overwhelmingly an African phenomenon today. So if you're really worried about the poorest of the poor, Africa is unfortunately where you need to look, because that is where they're going. It's sort of like cancer, when treated, retreats to small corners of the body commonly, and ultra poverty has been treated extensively, and we've seen it extinguished in much of the world, or close to extinguished, but it is retreated with a vengeance into much of sub-Saharan Africa. This is where we have to combat ultra poverty. And one of the really troubling things about ultra poverty is that it persists. It's not just a matter of people who are suddenly living on very little and they bounce back a couple of years later. You know, my wife and I were in grad school with 3 children. We were poor. But that was planned poverty. We chose to go to grad school. we knew we were going to bite the bullet. We knew we were going to live on WIC and our savings for a few years until we could get out, get a job, and be back taking care of our family. That's a completely different condition and obviously a much higher standard of living than 62 cents a day. Anyway, the big difference with Africa and the big difference with ultra-poverty is it tends to persist for a very long period of time. So let me give you a point of comparison, a somewhat dated point of comparison, because I've not yet found a well-updated version of this, what I think is kind of a landmark study by Census Bureau, a woman named Nathan, who looked at spell lengths in poverty, meaning if somebody's poor today, how long will it be before they exit poverty? And the striking thing is that the median spell length in poverty, meaning half of the people are poor that long or shorter, half are that are poor that long or longer, the median spell length in poverty in the United States back in the 1990s, big recession era, was only 4.5 months at a relatively high poverty line of about $15 a day in real terms today per person. So poverty was overwhelmingly just transitory. It was a short-term phenomenon. You lose your job, you're looking around for work, several months later you find a new job. Now I bet that the figure today is much higher than that because we have much more structural poverty today. I mean, the current jobless recovery from the Great Recession is telling lots of stories about extended unemployment periods. So I would bet that the median spell length today is appreciably longer than 4.5 months. Nonetheless, the point stands. Poverty is relatively short term for most people who suffer poverty in the United States. At a basic level, we can measure the median spell length. I have no idea what the median spell length is for the poor in rural Africa, because, and I'll be curious if Eric can correct me, I don't know of a data set yet where we've seen half of the people who were poor in the initial period we observed who have exited poverty by the most current period. I've looked at a whole lot of longitudinal household data sets in Africa. I've yet to find one where we can establish what the median spell length in poverty is. And some of these data sets span 1-2 decades now, and we don't see recovery like that. So you see people who are poor, here's the U.S. percent of population that's poor, and here's the time path in years, starting from a very high rate during the early 90s recession. By contrast, here are three different data sets that my group has constructed, where you see over periods of time ultra-poverty rates, like really low levels, a quarter a day per person, where you just don't see an appreciable fall. So ultra-poverty is persistent. And that is the part that is most troubling. It's not just the grinding standard of living for a short period of time, it's that this will go on indefinitely. You're a parent, and you don't know that your children will ever get out of the poverty that they're suffering when you are raising them, which is a really troubling feeling if you're a parent. And that long-term persistent ultra-poverty is very complicated. There are a lot of stories behind it. So there, it doesn't lend itself to magic bullet solutions. We wish it did. We wish it was as simple as give every child a textbook, or give every child a laptop, or inoculate every child against any of a host of childhood diseases. We wish it was quite that simple, but the problem is there's a whole complex of different things that conspire to keep people from being able to make the sort of advances they like. Now, let me be careful that I don't sound too kind of tragic and depressing and pessimistic about this. Again, the first story was it's capable. We can make tremendous progress. We saw that in East Asia. And a little later, I'll come to some evidence from a recent study that Sarah Peterson and I and a team from the University of San Francisco did on a heifer project in Rwanda, where we can document that simple things like the gift you give your family at Christmas, where you say you're sponsoring a meat goat for a family, we can show you that that makes a difference. It makes an appreciable difference. But it's important, before we get to what are the things we can do, to understand why is this problem there? Why is it that so many people suffer unnecessary, persistent ultra-poverty? Well, some people are born poor and stay poor. and we'll come to them in just a minute. Maybe the most troubling subgroup are the people who become poor unnecessarily. They don't start off that way, but something bad happens. And there are a lot of bad things that happen. The single biggest cause of descents into chronic poverty in Africa or anyplace else, it seems, from work by a guy named Hari Krishna, who's at Duke University and did his PhD here at Cornell, has a really nice book, the title of which gives away the punchline. The title is One Illness Away. And the point is, one illness is all it takes for households that hover right on the brink of catastrophic descents into long-term ultra poverty. One illness, a breadwinner who dies of malaria or contracts HIV/AIDS, a mother who dies in childbirth, any of these sorts of things can permanently set families back. So health shocks are the single biggest cause of descents into long-term chronic poverty in the developing world. They're also the single biggest cause of personal bankruptcies in the United States. For those of you who are unaware, account for about 60% of personal bankruptcies in the US, which is also a strong correlate of long-term problems in the US. After health shocks, the biggest covariate shock, as we economists refer to it, health shocks hit individuals, are imperfectly correlated across households and individuals, so we sometimes call them idiosyncratic shocks, meaning hitting one person at a time, imperfectly correlated. Conflict and war hit areas en masse. So think South Sudan right now, or think Syria right now. Just horrific situations where, if you're unfortunate enough to be living in those places, escaping the dangers, escaping the deprivations of a war zone is exceedingly difficult. I mean, you have to be pretty well off, very courageous, and or extremely lucky to get out of a war zone once things have really erupted. Isabel's nodding. She's done a bunch of work in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, which is kind of an off and on again war zone, but that's very true. Natural disasters are something that we're very cognizant of because they tend to make the news. You know, one of the unfortunate things about conflict is it makes the news when it starts, and after a while, media organizations get a little tired of showing that there are people getting killed. We're up to, what, almost 4 million people killed in the conflict in DRC. You know, it's an amazing number of people, but you would think that the Malaysian airline that's lost has killed more people than the conflict in DRC. Clearly, we're multiple orders of magnitude, you know, eight orders of magnitude different in scale of impact. You know. But drought, flood, these sorts of things have a big effect, especially where they wipe away people's productive assets. Floods that kill off, or droughts that kill off a herd, or a flood that washes away the trees and topsoil from a smallholder farmer's farm. Unemployment episodes for those who rely on work. And the punchline here is that in this country, bad things happen to us. In Canada, in Western Europe, bad things happen and we have safety nets. So we have government programs that step in and offer unemployment insurance, or offer SNAP, supplemental nutrition assistance programs, or public housing programs. We have a wide network of church-based and secular organization-based philanthropies and charities that will provide housing, will provide food, etc. Such things are largely non-existent in poor areas of the developing world, where people depend on their social networks, their kinship networks. Just not the same sort of apparatus in place. International NGOs step in and try to help. And they do an incredibly good job in very difficult circumstances with very meager resources. But the safety net just is nowhere near the same. And that matters a lot, not just because bad things happen and people can't recover, but also knowing that bad things can happen, people change their behaviors. And people change their behaviors in precautionary ways. They trade off the risk-return profile. For those of you who've ever had financial management, you know, people commonly take on higher risk for higher return. Well, if there's a safety net to catch you if things go badly, you can afford to take on risk because the downside is truncated. When nobody's going to protect you from the worst possibilities that might happen, you trade off reducing your risk, but that also usually means you reduce your expected. rewards, so you reduce expected gains. People take low-risk, low-return portfolios of activities in sub-Saharan Africa, rural sub-Saharan Africa, all the time. They forego improved cultivars, they forego jobs that require them to commute and leave their livestock behind where they can be raided, all sorts of things. So bad things happen. People either choose portfolios that leave them poor, or bad things happen and they get cast into poverty. So once they're poor, why do they remain poor? What's this kid doing?
Gathering leaves.
Close.
Sort of
firewood? No.
He's trying to make them grass.
Yeah, he's pulling the branches down so his goats can browse off the foliage on this tree in a rather denuded landscape during a dry season in a somewhat bad year in north central Kenya. This young man's father used to be the bank manager before the bank closed the branch in this area. And now, I don't remember exactly how old he was. He was like 12 or 13. He should have been in school. He was in school until his father lost his job. And they couldn't afford for him to continue paying school fees. And they couldn't afford to risk losing some of their livestock herds that they built up a bit while the dad was working and earning a steady income. So this son of relative privilege in this community up until 6 or 12 months earlier, suddenly out spending his days pulling branches down for goats to browse. So unlike you, when you were 12 or 13 and you were in school, learning and propelling yourself on to an elite education at a place like Cornell, this kid's prospects for growth are now completely stunted. So he's relatively healthy. He got a pretty decent start. I'll talk later about what happens when children don't get that start. But his education is now sharply limited because of a shock that hit with no safety nets. And because his family lacks access to finance. Without a job, his father can't borrow to do much of anything. It takes money to make money, is an old adage, very true. So solving financial markets failures, solving access to insurance, to credit, to savings is very important. Not in this area, but in a neighboring area, there are real problems in a community we've been working in for some time, because you've got mixed ethnicities, that groups were settled during a severe drought, groups were settled in an area that wasn't historically their land, and they can't always move their herds because they're a visibly identifiable ethnic group that the dominant groups in the area don't particularly like. They'll sort of tolerate them staying in their one little pocket, but they don't let them out. And so when droughts hit and the grass goes away, those the herds owned by that group of Baran herdsmen in northern Kenya have this disproportionate tendency to dump. So once people become poor and they have a hard time keeping their kids healthy, keeping their kids in school long enough that they can get out and get good jobs, they can't get collateral to borrow, they can't afford to invest themselves in better technologies. Oftentimes they've got visible markings, whether it's gender or ethnicity or race, that mean they just don't get the same opportunities. We wind up having this phenomenon that we economists commonly refer to as a poverty trap. So a self-reinforcing mechanism. Once poor, your optimal strategy is to do things that leave you poor, and the people around you don't invest in you, so they leave you poor as well, so that just continues indefinitely, and hence the persistent ultra-poverty. So that's part of what my group works on, is poverty traps. Why are poverty traps? So I should quiz faculty, because gods be everywhere. Does any faculty member know what that means? I only know because I've got teens. So for those who don't know, that's Hunger Games. So may the odds be ever in your favor that you're about to play this game that you almost surely will not win. And it's sort of this mocking term that's used in the Hunger Games. So who has a real shot at escaping poverty? Let's just do this as a visual. Would everyone stand up for just a moment, please? So one way of thinking about this is you take a room full of people and think about if we were the population of
sub-Saharan African kids born at any moment in time, how many of you are going to have a fighting shot to have a middle-class existence? So if basically everybody from here down would please sit down, unfortunately you all don't make it to primary school age. About 18% of underboys die in sub-Saharan Africa. So the next group is, how many of you will, this is where having a clicker would really be helpful. So if the remainder of you from about, let's go back over, if you guys could sit down, please. So about half of those who survive will never finish elementary school. Thankfully, this number is picking up very quickly and that number is falling. So the gradients are going in the right direction. These numbers are getting better, but you still get the core point that we're already down to a pretty modest group. Drop another couple of you, Sarah, if you just sit down. You know, you wound up getting to elementary school, but HIV positive before you get out of secondary school. If Ed would sit down, you know, got through all of it. Well, you guys can still stand, Megan and you guys can still stand. So that group, you know, Ed's unlucky enough that he got caught in a war zone. So we're left with just a relatively small group of those. And I probably got the number slightly wrong. You can sit, thank you. But you get the point that only a really small share have a halfway decent shot of what we would think of as a pretty low middle class existence. What by African rural terms is a reasonable existence. You got an education, you got through secondary school, you're healthy, you have a job where you have enough livestock or enough farmland that you can sustain yourself and your family, and you're not having to flee because of violence. So we think of these as the basics, right? You know, does anybody here not expect all of that right now for yourselves and your families and your closest friends? We all take that for granted, but it's a relatively uncommon outcome in rural Africa today. Again, things getting better and at a quick rate with respect to especially the first two, which is good. But real problems. You have a much higher likelihood of having unfortunate things happen. So how do those who do succeed, how do they do it? I'm just going to flip through these things rather than walking back and forth to click my laptop. Probably the single biggest thing is staying healthy. Again, the biggest reason for descents into chronic poverty are episodes of ill health or injury or unexpected death. So staying healthy is crucial, not least of which because kids who are severely malnourished, very sick, don't go to school, or if they go to school, they don't stay in school very long. So, you know, these are pretty healthy kids in a schoolyard in, this is Western Kenya. So, you know, these kids are pretty healthy. They're in a advanced primary school, I think. Probably year eights, year seven to year eights. Takes money to make money. Their families commonly have. This is an area where there's a bunch of cash cropping. There's a papaya cannery sort of just around the corner from this school. So families are planting papaya. They're harvesting it. They take it to the cannery. They make a reasonably good income off of the commercialized papaya that they grow. They plow it into school fees for their children. Their children then go off, get halfway decent jobs outside, take care of mom and dad, because by the way, there's no social security when you're old and tired and ready to retire. So they've got access to markets like this cannery that'll buy up their papayas, and they're living in a place that's reasonably peaceful. So they have sort of all the conditions my kids enjoy. My kids got vaccinations early on, were always well nourished. They had access to a terrific public education system. We had money to invest to be able to take care of them. They could get to markets for whatever they needed to do, to buy stuff, for me to sell stuff, being in my labor, and thankfully upstate New York is a peaceful place, at least in the right schools. So, you know, basically, if they live the life that our kids lead, they get the same sort of outcome. So it's that they don't get those chances that our kids get. And we can scale these things. So that's a lot of the magnitude of the problem, the causal reasons for the problem of persistent ultra-poverty. So the next question is, why should any of us care? Well, this is sort of preaching to the choir, because none of you would have showed up here if you didn't care.
So this is a variant of a talk I more commonly give at schools, at secondary schools or various colleges. And there are a variety of reasons why I try to convince people they should care. The first is a humanitarian ethical reason, sort of a simple golden rule principle common to all the world's major religions, as well as kind of secular humanism. That is the golden rule. We should treat others the way we want to be treated. None of us would want to be living the existence of these young girls in Madagascar. Does anyone know what they're doing? Sorry?
What's it, the grinding base?
Rice, yeah. So what are they doing?
Pounding.
Yeah, so this is the paddy. So this is stalks of rice harvested from the family's field. So they break off the straw, they take the grain, they dump it in here, mortar and pestle. You know, those of you who ever go see a drugstore, the old apothecary shop, this wasn't just for mixing medicines. Today, there's still people who use that to take the grain off of the stalk, and then they take it, turn it upside down, toss the remnants, clear out a lot of the debris, toss it onto this pan where they winnow, they get the remaining little leaves and things to go flying off the side as these grow. And it, you know, they laugh hysterically at you if you try this, because rice goes everywhere when I try this, and they don't lose a single grain because they're very skilled at it. But this is an everyday activity to get ready for the day's meal. So, you know, to me, the idea of my having to do that, or my having to make my kids do this every day before we go have our rice, is just, I would hate that. It bothers me to no end that their kids are spending their days doing this. The economic reasons. I mean, we're sitting here in the Dyson School. This is an undergraduate business program. So why pay attention to business? Because these guys are your future workforce. They're your future market. Depending upon whose numbers you believe, somewhere between 65 and 85% of growth in consumer product demand, food demand, basic consumer items, you know, iPods, tennis shoes, things like that, is going to come from the populations of middle and low income countries. So the OECD, the rich world, is declining in population over the next 20 years. And moreover, our incomes aren't going to grow very quickly. And even when they do, we're pretty well satiated on kind of the basic consumer things. So most consumer goods demand is going to come out of low and middle income countries, where income growth is much higher than in the rich countries, where population growth is dramatically higher, where urbanization rates are much faster because you still have large rural populations. We have very limited rural populations here. So more and more people moving into markets. So the future targets for a huge number of businesses around the world are going to be this population. And the faster their incomes grow, the healthier they are, the more likely they can keep stable jobs, the better your marketplace is, your Procter & Gamble, or your Nestle, or your PepsiCo. Moreover, they're going to be your future workforce, whether in the developing world or migrating into the high-income countries. So if they wind up physically stunted and cognitively held back because of malnutrition or ill health early in life, that's your future workforce. You probably don't want that. So you have an economic self-interest over the medium to long term. Security reasons and geopolitical reasons. We're a little troubled right now by what's happening in Central Asia, Crimea in particular. Syria is a huge concern in Washington right now. Later this week, I'm down in Washington giving a talk at the World Bank about a new book I have out, Food Security and Sociopolitical Stability, which was born of the National Intelligence Services in the United States recognizing in late 2011, after the Arab Spring, that governments were being threatened or falling in the Middle East and North Africa. This somehow seemed related to bread riots. Governments in places like Madagascar were falling over land deals. So sort of the world is coming unglued in some places. It's all related to food and the agricultural economy, and the national intelligence systems in the United States had no clue why and no analytical capacity to address it. So they came to Cornell and asked me if I'd gather a group of experts to look at these problems for them. And so we have a book that came out a few months ago on this. But this is, you know, at a very high level, that's a story of the highest level of foreign policy and national security policy people in the United States recognizing they had a vested interest in what's happening
to food systems in developing countries because it matters to whether the world is peaceful or not. Environmental concerns, you know, again, a picture from Madagascar, deforestation, extinction of incredibly biodiverse systems of flora and fauna. The endemism rate in Madagascar is off the charts. So when you take down forest and you lose habitat and a species of lemur dies, it doesn't exist anywhere else. So it's gone forever. And that's strongly related to the pressures people face in surviving. Controlling pandemics, there are a whole lot of reasons. So how do we help? So there are a bunch of ways we help. The most obvious, the one that people almost always come to first, is they say, oh, we have foreign aid, that the government has foreign aid programs. And that's true, we do have foreign aid programs. They're not particularly generous. It's worth about 7.5 cents a day per person. So, you know, if any of you buy a cup of coffee regularly, you've already accounted for a large chunk of your month's donations per capita. Moreover, this number is heavily overstated in the United States because of what's called tying, meaning we give money, but on the condition that you use that money to buy stuff from us, to hire university faculty from the United States to give you expert guidance, to buy food from the United States that comes in the form of old-fashioned food aid. Buy, you know, the United States has had at different points in time relatively generous population and family planning programs, but with the restriction that you have to buy all the condoms from the United States, which, by the way, costs 3 to 4 times what they are on the open market globally. So that's basically taking back a chunk of what we're giving away. So that aid tying is a problem that overstates these figures of how much we really get. If we could net out reliably the aid tying part, I bet we give more in private gifts than we do in foreign aid. We certainly do in episodes of disasters. Think the Haiti earthquake, or think the Indian Ocean tsunami of late 2004. The outpouring of generosity was huge. But the numbers averaged across individuals and over time are still small, about 6 cents per person per day. But this can be hugely influential. I'll come back to the example of the Rwanda heifer study Sarah and I were involved in just a moment. I would argue that the biggest way we make a difference, and this should resonate with those of you here in the College of Agriculture or here in the Dyson School, is the things you do that change the opportunities people face. So developing new technologies, better plant varieties, hardier livestock varieties, improve vaccines for livestock or for humans, new information communications technologies, all these sorts of things. Better institutions, just helping to improve governance over natural resources or over markets through better judicial systems. Better policies. You know, we economists like to think that we can come up with better ways for governments and firms to manage scarce resources through smart policy. So all these sorts of things matter a lot. The biggest contributor to economic growth over time, sustainable economic growth in particular, is what economists think of as technological change, meaning the productivity of all the stuff, the inputs that generate the outputs that we value. There's only so much in the way of soil and sunlight and water in the world. So the real question about how much can we produce is how productive are we in deploying finite resources. So universities and businesses, all of us, have a huge impact insofar as we can stimulate productivity growth through developing technologies, et cetera. But we can also make a difference where relatively small transfers of scarce resources are well-targeted at key populations. And this is the brief heifer story that I think was the particular reason why Megan asked me to come speak. There are a couple of chairs if you guys want to come in. So this is I'm just going to give you the kind of takeaway messages from a recently published, earlier this year, we published a paper on Heifer International's programs in Rwanda, in two parts of Rwanda in particular, down in the far southeast in an area known as Kurehe, where meat goats were being given to families, so participating families were given a goat, and up in the more central part where dairy cows were being
give it away to families. So in both cases, it was a livestock donation program. Individual families given a livestock, and then as Megan mentioned before, later on, after our study period, the pay it forward principle was supposed to come into play. So that the progeny of the livestock that they were given was to be given away to other households in the community, so that over time, the gift propagates across the community. When we came in working, Heifer had approached my colleague Bruce Weidick at the University of San Francisco, and approached Bruce. He'd been doing a long-term study of a group called Compassion International that sponsors children, so people donate money for child sponsorships. And Bruce and some of his students and a collaborator at the University of Minnesota had carefully documented the long-term causal impacts of this child sponsorship. They could document that children who were part of the sponsorship program did appreciably better than otherwise identical children who weren't. They used a little trick in how Compassion ran its child sponsorship programs, that it would only sponsor kids who are, I think it was age 12 or younger. So they'd get kids who were ages 11 and 12 who got sponsored, and their siblings who were ages 13 and 14 who weren't sponsored. Same family, same village, same period, same macroeconomic shocks, etc. And they could study over a period of a generation what happened to these kids later on. So they could demonstrate pretty convincingly the impact of child sponsorship programs. So Heifer got wind of this project that Bruce had undertaken and said, we'd like to know if animal donations have the same sort of cool effect that we can go convince donors to give us more money because it has a big impact. So Bruce said, I live in San Francisco. I don't know much about goats and cows. That sounds like a Cornell kind of thing. So Bruce called me up, and thankfully I could convince Sarah, who had been living in Rwanda and was heading back to East Africa anyway that summer, so I could convince Sarah to go lead the field team to coordinate all the data collection. And they did a terrific job. So Rosemary and Svetlana did this as their master's projects in Rwanda, and we bundled their two projects together and turned it into a paper. The design of this was that Heifer has some criteria by which they decide whether you are qualified to receive a donated animal or not. So you take a population in a village, you kind of enumerate everybody, you look at the criteria, which basically boil down to, are you sufficiently poor that we should be giving you something? They don't really want to give it to people who are already doing quite well, thank you. But you're not so poor that you couldn't possibly take care of this animal. That, you know, if you're going to eat it the day after we give it to you, then you're not going to get much out of this. Or if it's just going to die because you have no place to shelter it from rain or disease, we don't want to give you an animal, have it die, and we've lost it. So they basically are targeting, think of it as the middle class of the village, although I caution you, middle class in these villages does not mean middle class the way you and I think of it here. But not the wealthiest, not the poorest. So they qualify everybody. And then Sarah and her team show up. And they show up when some of the people who were qualified had received animals, and an almost equally sized group had not yet received animals. But they were all qualified. And the assignment into having already gotten an animal or not, nobody could quite figure out what the rules were. This was actually a subject of considerable discussion and a lot of consternation on our part, because we were concerned that it'd be reasonably random. We convinced ourselves over time that it was. So we could compare the beneficiaries against people who were qualified but not yet beneficiaries in the animal donation programs to get something that resembled a controlled experiment. And then we could control separately for the people who had never been beneficiaries. And there are two different central findings that we get out of this. The first is we look at these households that receive these animals, what happens to their diets? You might think that their diets would just get hugely better. Suddenly they're eating a wide variety of foods. In fact, their dietary change is important but modest and concentrated really on just the thing they were given. So those who got dairy cows were consuming appreciably greater dairy products. They were getting about 9.3 liters
Oh, I thought I said Gale. I was like, that's not Gale. That's
not harsh. But this was about three times the intake of control households. So otherwise identical qualified households who had not yet received the animal, these guys were getting a lot more dairy. So their kids were drinking milk regularly because they had a dairy cow. This is pretty intuitive. This is not rocket science. But it's nice to see that it works as designed, right? Similarly, those who got donated meat, goats, they got appreciably more meat because they would keep their goat, the goat and kid, they keep some of the kids, and they can start slaughtering animals, harvesting them, eating them. So the meat intake was about double that of control households. So there really was increased dietary intake of high-value animal source foods. You know, this is an area where we're not worrying a whole lot about, oh, we should go vegetarian because there's too much fat and calories. This is a population that desperately needs every ounce of fat, calorie, protein, micronutrients they can get. So promoting animal source foods is a really good thing in these rural Rwandan populations. Dietary intake in and of itself isn't necessarily what we care about. What we really want to know, are we getting kids healthier as a result of this? And so the best indicators are nutritional status of children as measured by anthropometric indicators, so height for weight, weight for age, weight for height, these sorts of measures for young kids, preschool age, up to 5 years old. So what we found was that using several different techniques for trying to get proper controls in place, receiving a donated animal caused a statistically significant gain of about half a standard deviation in weight for age measures, which is kind of one summary measure of nutritional status, a slightly lower gain of about 4/10 of a standard deviation in weight for height, which is a very common measure of short-term nutritional status. So low weight for height scores, otherwise known as wasting scores, are indicators of acute malnutrition, meaning short-term malnutrition. But meat goats generated only a relatively modest effect on long-term measures of nutritional well-being, height for age, which is in its severe negative manifestations is referred to as stunting. Kids are permanently short for their age or stunted. So it generated an improved effect on height for age measures, but pretty modest and statistically insignificant. So meat goats helped, but not hugely.
Is this because you only had a very short period of time?
It's probably a couple of things. One is it's a short period of time. One is a single meat goat per household. You know, how big an effect do you really think you could get, especially how big a long-term effect do you think you could get? In the short term, while they can sustain, and yeah, we've got a little bit of a herd of goat here, then you can expect that they really are going to have a bit of increase in meat intake, and that will translate into at least short-term improvements in child nutrition, maybe not long-term ones. It would be interesting to see.
But that you don't know.
But we don't know.
He didn't have a long enough period.
Exactly. We can only make relatively short-term statements. What I find much more encouraging is the dairy cattle donation. So giving a household a relatively low-value dairy cow. It's not like getting something from a dairy farm in this area. But you know, this has a half a standard deviation improvement in height for age in this long-term measure. So daily dairy intake is having a pretty big long-term impact on these kids' nutritional status, their long-term nutritional status indicator.
Is there an index of how this intake was distributed within the household? Like if it was for the child or it was distributed equally among the members?
Do we know who's actually drinking the milk?
Yeah.
We don't, I think there's good reason to believe that if you worried about a concentrated distribution, like that the man gets the milk because the man is the powerful one, he's the one who has to have energy to go work out outside the house someplace, that if that were true, we wouldn't see these impacts. I mean, keep in mind, these are really little kids. These are preschool age kids. So they're commonly last claimants on new food resources in households where there's a severe concentration. But we don't observe exactly how food is distributed. That sounds like it should be something that's pretty easy to figure out. It's actually really hard to get accurately. So we didn't even bother to try. Yes, please.
What was the average delay from receipt of the animal to your recommend?
About a year.
Year. Didn't start about a year and a half. Yeah, no. So average was about a year.
About a year.
Yeah.
Is it?
Sorry.
Yeah.
The average among beneficiaries they had about a year. So some gain in wait for age as well from Derek. But the punchline, we can't do a proper cost-benefit analysis, I hasten to add some chagrin, because there are a lot of effects we can't put values on. Eric's point that these are very short-term results, and if you're investing in child nutrition, you're really investing for the long term. We did some back-of-the-envelope stuff based on what the literature tells us about improvements in adult earnings associated with improvements in child anthropometric status. At the end of the day, we didn't believe numbers ourselves, so we just got rid of that part of the manuscript. So we would like to be able to do proper cost-benefit analysis. These are relatively expensive investments. A goat is $200, if I'm remembering right, and a cow is about $1,000 total delivered cost.
I thought the cow was like $2,500.
Okay, maybe the cow is $2,500. I thought it was a little bit, anyway. But these are not, so when you contribute $50 for a goat, you're actually contributing only part of a goat. So you have to aggregate up across quite a few people to actually donate a goat or a cow to a household. And these effects are real, but do they net out? Is this the best use of the scarce donated resources you make? I honestly don't know the answer to that question. I wish I did. That was our big objective. We actually ran this exercise in another country too, where it turned out Heifer wasn't quite sure of how they were doing their allocations in the field, and so we wound up not being able to convince ourselves we really had reasonable controls in place. So we couldn't convince ourselves that we had good measures, so we didn't want to share those with others. But this is clearly doing something positive for the children in these beneficiary households. So if you wonder, if you write a check or give your credit card number to Heifer, or presumably some other organizations that do similar things, it clearly is having a favorable effect on the diets and the nutritional status of kids. So what can you do? The first thing I commonly tell students is take advantage of the opportunities you have that these kids don't have. I mean that quite seriously. We often, those of us who care about these sorts of issues, sometimes feel racked by guilt that, well, I have these opportunities, you just told me stories about kids who don't have a chance to finish elementary school, much less go to some Ivy League university. You have this opportunity, use it. Take advantage of the skills you can acquire here, and then go do something useful with it. There are a lot of ways that you can do that, but agonizing over your good fortune does nothing to help people in rural Africa, I can assure you. One thing you can do, and you can do it articulately, the more you spend time learning to read, write, and speak, is speak up to our political leaders, because those meager little aid budgets are under threat all the time. And the things we do, like peacekeeping in all around the world, matter a lot to the likelihood of kids escaping poverty or families falling into long-term poverty. Third thing you can do is, with your newfound riches after you cash in your Cornell degree and go get a great job, go sponsor a child with Heifer. Or, you know, my family years ago took to for holidays and anniversaries and things. You know, for Father's Day every year, I get given some sort of gift to a community. All of my kids have had sponsored children all their lives, so that they write letters back and forth, and we pay for the education and health care of a child for each of my kids. You know, it connects them to it, and frankly, it's a lot better than spending money on Power Rangers or Skittles and other sorts of stuff that's gone or trashed. Later.
I need to take you back, but on the previous slide.
Uh-huh. I can go back to that.
Yeah, did you look at rate of change of weight or rate of change of height?
Yeah.
Other than stuff?
This is a pure cross section. Mm-hmm. So this is a pure cross section, so we can't look at acceleration or deceleration growth. We can only compare two children who are otherwise identical match statistically. See what's the difference in levels. We can't look at changes in cross-section. Dan?
That's very consistent with other similar studies, even with older kids, that you get more of a boost in height with dairy or the other type of growth. And you also get more cognitive development with the meat than you do with the
more cognitive development with the media.
But that would be a tough thing to give you resources.
This is a bare, Sarah can attest, this is a bare bones exercise.
I carry the scale in my backpack on that one.
Good thing she's fit.
Did you recalibrate it every time?
Yeah. I lost a lot of weight on that trip, too.
My college graduation quote, my college yearbook was this brief passage from Christian scripture: "To whom much has been given, much is expected." Again, we get phenomenal opportunities. Capitalize on those opportunities and then do something really productive with it for those who can get them. Because there are lots of people who don't have the same good fortune you do. And sort of the antithesis of a quote from scripture is a quote from a secular anthropologist, right? But one of my very favorite quotes, Margaret Mead, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has." You know, by all means, talk to your political leaders, encourage them, tell your congressmen, tell Senator Gillibrand or Senator Schumer that you want them to support foreign aid, especially education, health programs, agriculture programs in low-income countries. But simple little things like organizing a student group on a college campus that builds awareness or raises a little bit of money can do it a lot. And here in the College of Agriculture, we have a particularly good opportunity. The quote that sat on my door for years here was literally the opening sentences of a Nobel Prize acceptance speech by Ted Schultz. "Most of the people in the world are poor, so if we knew the economics of being poor, we would know much of the economics that really matters. Most of the world's poor people earn their living from agriculture, so if we knew the economics of agriculture, we would know much of the economics of being poor." That quote is why I became an agricultural economist. Quite literally. I grew up in farm country, but I wasn't a farmer, and I didn't know much about agriculture, but I cared about poverty, I learned something about economics. When I thought about how to make the two match, I happened to stumble across Ted Schultz's acceptance speech, and I applied to an ag economic newspaper. So Africa is the world's most agrarian continent, and those of you who are in cows learning the skills of agriculture, whether it's the biophysical part or the social science part, you have the opportunity to build skill sets that can really make a difference. If you had been born to a poor woman in rural Africa, what would you want others to do? What's this woman doing? What's in her hands? Anybody know what this is?
It's called tea.
It's not tea. Has some of the same properties as tea. So has anyone ever heard of cotton or chat?
So
this is cotton. So what is she doing with it? Why is she? So for those who don't know what cotton is a wild medicinal plant that's chewed by young men in the Arabian Peninsula who are notorious for sitting around chewing cotton all day long. Sort of has a narcotic effect. So they get a buzz out of it, they feel good, they don't get upset that they don't have a job.
When you chew, we juice is hot milk too.
Yeah.
That's the reason she's got it. This is a 6-year-old child. She can't feed her child, so she's numbing the pain of hunger by feeding them a drug. And this is a recurring thing. I mean, it's a really painful thing to see. But if you take time in very poor communities, you will see this sort of thing all the time. And if you were that mother's child, you would want somebody to do something to help you, rather than just have her rely on numbing your pain with a narcotic. So you'd much rather see these kinds of guys having fun in your So that's all I had to say. Hopefully it gives you a little sense of kind of what makes me tick and why I chose to go into the line of work that I do. And I would just like to close by emphasizing that I do virtually nothing to help these people, so at least nothing directly. What I can do is I can help inform people who can do something. I can help teach those of you who can go off and help you acquire skills. Never underestimate the power to take what you learn a place like Cornell, go off and get a good job, do some really productive things, create jobs for these kids' parents, develop new technologies so that these families are able to do things that they couldn't do before, make money and donate it to groups that use it really wisely to make an impact for them and their siblings. You know, you don't have to go into development to have an impact on development. That's all I have to say.
Thanks, Chris. Last year, I think there was an article covered about Give Directly. I think it was initially covered by NPR and a few other news outlets. This is an organization in Kenya that's giving money, cash transfers directly through M-Pesa. I think it was one that happened. And within that article, they cited Haifa International as a comparison. And since then, most people have tried to go to Haifa International to say, how much does it actually cost you to give out a cow? And from what I understand, Haifa International refused to give out that data. Since you guys work directly with them, is there some traction to that, the efficacy of giving through Haifa International as opposed to opportunities of giving
data? So for those who aren't aware of what Dr. Mumbai is referring to, so Give Directly is one of a bunch of different organizations, movements, that attempts to channel cash directly to needy individuals. Especially in the cell phone era, M-Pesa, which is the M is the prefix in Swahili meaning person, Pesa is the word for money, so it literally means money person or banker. And it's a software program that sits on a cell phone on the Safaricom network that has taken over and is now, as I understand it, it's now the single largest source of cash flows in Kenya, the country where this started. So it has more cash flows than a regular bank, than any banking system branch does, so relative to Kenya Commercial Bank, more money flows through M-Pesa than Kenya Commercial Bank. So the idea is, if I give my money to Give Directly and it just makes an M-Pesa transfer to Ed's cell phone, won't the money appearing on Ed's cell phone with no intermediation do more than the same amount of money invested through Heifer International, which goes and buys animals and hires vets and has to rent a truck to move the animals out to the village, et cetera. But doesn't cash work better? You know, I'm an economist, so the answer to me has to be it depends. My union card's revoked, but that's not my knee-jerk answer. But I think it's true that it really does depend. Cash matters a lot in many circumstances. But cash into places that can't buy what people need doesn't help much at all. It just inflates the economy. So in a lot of the really remote rural areas that I spent time in, or that I was showing you some pictures of, cash transfers wind up having relatively negligible effects, I suspect, although I can't prove that, because there's just not, you can't go buy herds. You know, it's just not available. You can't pay for the things you want to pay for. You can't pay to send your kids to a school if there's no school there. You got to build the school. So there are some cases where cash, I think, is really a better instrument. And now that we can deliver cash pretty quickly, reliably, inexpensively, I'm a big believer in cash transfers as a big improvement, but not for everything.
Thank you very much for an inspiring presentation. I did have a very quick question about the ultra poverty trend. If you look at the typical $1.25 per day poverty line, the progress in sub-Saharan Africa has been remarkable. Between 2000 and 2010, it went down from something like 55% to 40%. Let me first start with 125 a day. It went down from something like 55 to 48%. Now, what I find very surprising, your definition of ultra-poverty being 65 cents a day, you do have a significant reduction to 2005, and suddenly you have this upturn. And this is quite possible, but it would appear to be a little bit inconsistent with this almost miracle growth period that sub-Saharan Africa has undergone between 2000 and 2012-14, there really has been a quantum jump in GDP per capita growth out of the 37 countries for which we have data. I think in 33 of them, we saw significant acceleration of growth. So I was just wondering, do you have any explanation as to why you have this reversal between 2005 and 2010?
Well, so the first and most important point is this is one data point.
Yeah.
So I'd be really careful not extrapolating a trend out of this. This trend, I believe it, and I think that's the story you were talking about too. We know that the 80s and 90s were two very difficult decades in sub-Saharan Africa. And sometime around 2000, things began to improve appreciably, much not all of the continent. And that's manifest in a significant fall in the headcount rate of ultra-poverty. In the data, in the World Bank data, it seems to turn up. And the question becomes, is this accurate? First, have no idea whether it is accurate or not. Or if it is accurate, why would that be? So assume for the moment it is accurate. My own hypothesis about this is twofold. First, you know, come back to my cancer metaphor from earlier. If you look country by country, you know, you look at places like Ghana, you look at places like Rwanda, this is probably accelerating downward because these are places that are enjoying really rapid and increasingly inclusive growth. But the places that are seen, those are also places in which population growth is slowing incredibly rapidly. The places that have high population growth and that's staying high are the places that are most poor and most problematic. It's Niger, it's DRC, it's Zimbabwe, it's CAR, et cetera. So part of what I think we're seeing going on is that we're capturing those pockets into which ultra-poverty is retreating, and those places are growing disproportionately fast. So we've sort of taken much of the bottom out of the relatively high growth, relatively well-governed, relatively well-market integrated places, and we're now down to a pocket of places where markets don't work, governments don't work, and people are having lots of kids in part to cope with the fact that markets and governments can't help them out. My sense as part of the story is that we're getting a bifurcation. We're getting things getting a lot worse in some places that are growing too quickly, and things getting a lot better in places that are in demographic terms, decelerating their things.
It's just a question, I guess, but isn't that also a period of time where you've had a lot of large-scale expropriation of land and also a lot of warfare going on? It's not inconsistent with what you said. I mean, those places you cited, there's a lot of conflict, and you know, there's been a lot of clearances of people from land to grow oil palm, this and that.
So conflict. The story I was just telling you, the places I was talking about, conflict is a huge issue.
Yeah.
On a continental scale, conflict has subsided a little bit in sub-Saharan Africa. Think of places like Liberia, Sierra Leone, et cetera, that were engaged in Uganda, just brutal civil conflict that's subsided. So I don't think increased conflict would be explaining this. It continued and sometimes increasingly brutal conflict in those pockets in which the properties were treated, yes, but at a continental scale, probably not. The land grabs part is an interesting feature that, for those of you who are unaware, you know, in the 2007 to 2009 period, right after global food prices spiked, suddenly outside investors started going into much of sub-Saharan Africa incredibly quickly to buy up land. So the government of Madagascar fell because Daewoo Logistics, the big South Korean conglomerate, struck a sweetheart deal with the government of Madagascar for 1.3 million hectares of prime rice land. The terms of this deal were terribly opaque. It was clear that the government officials involved were taking a pretty big cut. There were lots of other reasons the population had grievances with the Ravulamanan government at the time, but the government was overthrown by a Thanavivo-based disc jockey in January of 2009 over this land deal. So this was a pretty serious episode. And those land deals were taking off across the country to the extent that in 2009, there was more land deals from outsiders into Africa than the entirety of the agricultural lands of Northwest Europe. So if you were to draw a boundary from Denmark, Germany, I don't remember whether Switzerland was in this or not, but France, Belgium, Luxembourg, Netherlands, that whole huge part of Northwestern Europe, all of the agricultural lands was the equivalent of 1 year's worth of land investments by outsiders into sub-Saharan Africa in the year 2009. It's a mind-boggling figure. We don't know how much of that was actually used, though. So the purchase of the rights did not lead to mass displacement. And we have really bad data on how many of those acres were actually occupied, how many people really got kicked off. But that's a reasonable hypothesis, because the scale of these transactions was so big, you can imagine it could really have displaced people. But I have no idea whether that's really the mechanism behind it. But just a kind of mind-boggling scale of these deals taking place, most of them with very little transparency. So there's a really nice chapter by Klaus Deininger in this book on that very issue of land transactions around the developing world. Any questions or comments?
Yeah, the slide about U.S. government aid and a cents per person, and then I just was curious, maybe I missed it, who's the per person? Certain people under the poverty line?
No, United States population, sorry. So per American.
Oh, per,
yeah.
Oh, I got you.
Per American per day.
Okay.
You're anting up a whopping 7.5 cents.
Okay.
Yeah, don't spend it all on this. Great. Well, thank you. Enjoy your evening. That's been about